as usual, to welcome our host, Robert Enright, and honored to welcome Jim Dine to Perimeter Institute. I'm going to have my colleague, Alf Bogusky, director of the KW Art Gallery, come and say a few words in just a second. Just before I do that, a reminder that after all our events in the Mike Lazaridis Theater, you're always welcome to come up to the Black Hole Bistro on the fourth floor, which you find by taking the elevator on that side of the building, or taking the stairs on that side. Come up, something to eat, something to drink, meet Robert, meet Jim Dine. Be a real pleasure to see you up there. As I said, this is a collaboration with our colleagues at the KW Art Gallery, and please welcome my colleague, Alf Bogusky.
Thank you. It's like passing a baton. Thank you, Michael. And thank you for your collaboration. The Perimeter Institute is really a fabulous addition to this community, and its cultural expressions are certainly of global import, and it's a real honor for the Kitchener-Waterloo Art Gallery to be part of this cultural series, and particularly doing events like tonight. It's my job to introduce Robert Enright, which I've had the pleasure of doing on other occasions, and again tonight. He's the host of this Artist Talk series, of course, and he comes to us first from Winnipeg, which is their claim, where he's the senior contributing editor to Border Crossings magazine. It's a publication which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, and I can't express strongly enough how important it is for people to be aware of that publication. It's a great addition to the Canadian cultural scene, and it's one that, as I've said before, if you aren't a subscriber, you are definitely culturally deprived, so you should be a subscriber. He also comes to us from Guelph, so we're happy to have him here, resident in the area, dividing his time between the communities. And he is the University Research Chair in Art Criticism in the School of Fine Art and Music at the University of Guelph. Enright's had 25 years' experience as a cultural commentator and writer, is well known. He's worked with CBC Radio and Television. He's also contributed to the arts pages of the Globe and Mail, to which has contributed over 95 features and reviews. And his work is found in a number of international art magazines, including Art Review, Modern Painters, Art News. The March issue of Freeze magazine will feature a city profile of the city of Winnipeg, which has, I think you likely know, quite an interesting cultural milieu. Winnipeg being where it is, you've got to make your own fun, and definitely they know how to do it in that city so well, and there's such major cultural figures there. So this profile will be written by Robert, and there'll be additional contributions by Guy Madden, a filmmaker, and Marcel Zama. Enright's also written extensively for art galleries in Canada, the US, and Europe, contributing over 20 catalog introductions and essays. He's done work for us recently, which we're very grateful for, and written essays about a number of American artists, including Leon Golub for the Ronald Fellman Fine Arts Gallery in New York, and on June Leaf for the Tingley Museum in Basel. His most recent publications include an essay on photographer William Aiken for the Image and Inscription Anthology, published by Gallery 44 and YYZ Books. And he's also created an essay on the work of LA photographer Melanie Pullen from the Nasrallah Press. He's received 14 nominations at Western and National Magazine Awards, won 4 gold and 2 silver medals for his writing in Border Crossings. He's also collaborating with our featured speaker tonight, Mr. Dine, on a spoken autobiography that will be published by Steidl in Germany. In the audience, if I might segue, are two people who are both very special to Mr. Dine and to Robert. The first, from New York via Paris, Diana Michener, the very noted American photographer who also, if I might reveal, is Mrs. Jim Dine. And Mika Walsh, who is, they're sitting together here, so I'm going to actually finger them out here. Mika, if you can raise your hand so people have a sense of higher, please, come on. Mika is the editor of Border Crossings, and she's a critic and fiction writer. She comes to us from Winnipeg, and it's no secret in the art world that her and Robert are a number. So on behalf of the Perimeter Institute and the Kitchener-Waterloo Art Gallery, I'd like to welcome you all here tonight. And it's my pleasure to introduce Robert Enright.
A number. I should say, by the way, I'll speak into the mic. Can you hear me without the microphone? Probably not. You can, because I have a microphone on, as is Jim. I'm pleased to say that. I should mention briefly that in January of 2007, the Kitchener-Waterloo Art Gallery will, in fact, feature a show of work on the theme of Pinocchio by Jim Dine, which I think is extraordinary. So what happens tonight will only be the beginning of what will be an ongoing relationship between Mr. Dine and this community, which if I have had anything to do with, I can't tell you how delighted I am. I've actually written an introduction for Jim, because otherwise I'll just go on and on, and that's not why we're here, to hear me go on. So bear with me briefly. These are facts, and facts, of course, as you know, are true. Everyone in the audience is a journalist, began to laugh because we know about facts. Jim Dine was born in Cincinnati, Ohio on June 16, 1935. From 1953 to 57, he studied at the University of Cincinnati, graduating with a BFA degree. He did a further year of graduate work at that institution, and he also studied at the Boston Museum School. When he was 12 years old, his mother died. He would later describe her death as an amputation, and he subsequently went to live with his maternal grandparents. His grandfather owned a hardware store, an environment in which he familiarized himself with the tools that were to become such important objects in his art. His father, with whom Jim had an unsatisfactory relationship, also owned a store, and in those two places, the soon-to-be artist could be found, in his own words, daydreaming among objects of affection. He calls tools a support system for his soul. Dine moved to New York in 1958, a city he described as a vast palette, and quickly established himself in an art world where the dominance of abstract expressionism was being challenged by a group who came to be known as pop artists. Jim will have something to say about that categorization, I'm sure. In 1958, he and Claus Oldenburg founded Judson Gallery, where Dine would present the Smiling Workman, an early happening, as they were termed at the time. In 1960, he staged another happening called Car Crash at the Rubin Gallery, which he had joined in 1959. His performance pieces have taken on the patina of legend, while Jim sees them as being about his ability to get his bad dreams into art. The primary subject of his art has been being able to call up the darkness, and he candidly says that his dreams are about the basement. That's where I'm healthiest. The late 50s and early 60s was a period in American art when Dine described as assemblage time, and he continued to gather material from the urban environment of New York, as well as from his personal storehouse of memory and experience. In addition to the tools, which he's persisted in regarding as objects of affection, Dine began to develop other subjects, pieces of clothing, his palette board, the heart, and most famously in 1963, the bathrobe, which could be used as surrogate self-portraits. And Black Bathroom Number 2, by the way, which he did in 1962, I should say, is one of the sterling pieces in the collection of the Art Gallery of Ontario, and they have it, I think, mostly in their permanent collection on display. One never knows what they now have on display, of course, at the Art Gallery of Ontario. Dine's reputation continued to grow, as did his unease with an art world in which he found such easy success. He moved to London with his family. He had married Nancy Minto in 1967, and they had three sons, in what amounted to a self-directed exile. In England, he did everything from design sets and costumes for a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream to writing poetry and developing his mastery of printmaking. He had a solo show at the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam in 1966, and a retrospective at the Whitney Museum in 1970, when he was only 35 years old. In 1971, he and his family moved back to Vermont, well, to Vermont for the first time, they moved back to America, and within 4 years, Dine had begun an intense, extended period of drawing from the figure. Drawing has always been virtuoso territory for him, but these works were extraordinary and remain one of the great achievements of American art in the last century. Dine is enraptured of what he describes as a romance about looking, and he remains one of the closest lookers in contemporary art. Jim Dine continues to work at an astonishing rate, producing paintings, drawings, sculpture, and recently photo-based art. The range of the surrogate self-portraits has also expanded. You can find Dine in his crows, and you can find him equally at home in the character of Pinocchio, about which subject he has now produced drawings, painting, and sculpture, the full range of media that this enormously gifted and hardworking artist uses. He told Constance Glenn in 1983 that he was very proud to be a workman. "I'm proud to work hard," he says, and he continues to do exactly that. Please join me in welcoming, for the first time in 35 years to Canada, Jim Dine.
Nice to be back. Can you hear me? It's okay. I'm going to, the program is going to be like this. I've written a memoir of my life as a draftsman because it's meant so much to me and it's informed so much else of my art. And I thought I'd read that and then Enright and I will talk a little bit. It's called Putting Down Marks. I've always had a wish to put down marks. As a boy, I knew I was going to be an artist. I was continually drawing. When I was 12 years old, I realized I couldn't do what I wanted to do with my hands. I not only could not draw what I saw, I could not sit with the drawing. I'm talking about when I was in the seventh grade. There was a boy in the class who could draw caricatures of people, and I was very envious of him. He already had developed a style, a line. I had a passion, but it was thwarted by personal things. At the time, my mother had just died, and I was in deep unhappiness. I felt I'd been slugged. I couldn't concentrate on anything, not even drawing. I knew I had this calling, but I couldn't do anything with it. I just stored it. All I could do was doodle. I was aimlessly moving the pencil on my mathematics pad, in the margin on books, on anything, making people's faces, geometric designs, etc. My mind was going, and so was my hand. When I was 16, I bought some oil paint and a board, and I set up a still life in my grandma's house, and I immediately painted the objects accurately. I was totally shocked by it, particularly the way I painted a piece of rye bread. Now, maybe if I saw this little painting today, it would look awful. But then I was amazed by what I could do. It wasn't drawing, it was painting, and with oil paint, you can hide a lot. But still, it was a beginning. I started painting in adult classes at the Art Academy of Cincinnati at night, but I really didn't know what I was doing. I knew Picasso had done something to do with abstraction. I sort of was trying to paint shapes and things, attempting to be a modern artist, and then for my 18th birthday, I bought myself a book called Modern Prints and Drawings by Paul Sachs. It was a survey of the prints and drawings he loved. I used it like a Bible. At first, I gravitated to the German Expressionist printmakers, Kirchner, Nolde, and Beckmann, because they made big, big, strong statements in black and white. But when I saw the Matisse lithograph from 1913, the one that's got her head sort of cut off on the bias and is just a line drawing, I thought, my God, to be able to do that in one line. In 1955, I went to Ohio University, Athens, Ohio. And the one thing I wanted to do was to draw. I drew from my imagination. Not from the model, because in those days at Ohio University, in Athens, Ohio, was in the so-called Bible Belt. There were no nude models. In fact, there weren't any models that I recall, and there certainly weren't nude ones. And I know that because we tried to get nude ones, and finally, a few years later, got a big old woman to come down from Columbus and pose naked. I immediately was able to draw her in a rather stylish way. It wasn't accurate necessarily, but because of all the close looking I had done in my life, suddenly I was able to focus and make my hand do what I wanted to do. From that moment, I knew drawing was essential to me. It kept me alive, and it kept alive the need I had for family. It gave me a line of tradition that led from me back to artists I admired, not just Rembrandt and Picasso, Matisse and Degas, but others who are dismissed, but who gave their lives to drawing, some in an academic way, some in a personal way. Everybody I looked at taught me something. When I left college, I went to New York. This was 1958. During those years, the early 60s, late 50s, I struggled to find my own voice through drawing objects that were familiar to me. Hand tools I had loved since I was a boy, plain chairs, sinks, faucets, isolated in space. Usually it was a single object, very intensely observed. I wanted to use objects that were not traditional, but I also yearned to have my feet in historical drawing. By the late 60s, because I was etching like crazy, I was starting to get closer to depicting objects the way I saw them. The making of hard ground etchings really made me look at what I was squeezing out of my hand. In 1972, I made a series of drawings called 52 Drawings for Cy Twombly. They were on individual sheets, but they were about this big. It was a library of small hand tools. They were meant to be read serially around a room in a single row like a movie. In Vermont in 1974, I started to make drawings of humans. I made 4 drawings of my wife. They were expressive drawings of her head. Then I made some nude drawings of her, and they looked fully realized to me as drawing. I hired student models because there was a college in the town, and I had 4 or 5 months of making academic studies. I wanted the anonymity of strangers. 2 or 3 women came, and they were perfectly charming, and they happily sat while I drew them. Then I realized I had a neighbor, Jesse Heller, who was 19 years old and had a very athletic body. I was able to see in her arms and her shoulders and the rest of her body how nature puts us together. I decided to use Jesse. She was my live anatomy book. When I started to draw her, this was in 74 or 5, I was doing nothing else. I gave it 2 or 3 hours in the morning, 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon, just looking. So for the first year, I drew Jesse. I probably made 10 drawings in a year, but there were maybe 100, 200 drawings underneath because I never trusted to leave a drawing. I always have to elaborate, unlike Matisse. I love building up, erasing, losing it, bringing it back, taking it away. I trust my method of not trusting. I want the drawing always to be better. Drawing for me was and is such a specifically non-lying technique. With painting, you can move the matter around, and it can be beautiful, but not in drawing. For me, drawing is all about looking, looking hard, seeing it, taking it out, putting it back again to see if I rebuild it better. I can imagine that if I live 200 years, I'll still be correcting. It's the corrections that are interesting. They are the history of each drawing. What draws me to Giacometti are the corrections, not the drawings themselves. I don't think he was a great draftsman, by the way. He was an excellent miniaturist. He always was so frightened of failure and of finishing. He was so frightened of finishing anything, and that moves me. The best drawing of Giacometti's I ever saw wasn't a drawing. It was a plaster portrait about 2 inches high of Simone de Beauvoir. It's as good a drawing as I ever saw, and all it was a little plaster, but he caught it. He had looked very hard. I thought, and still do, that to be able to draw the figure the way I wanted it to be was a goal to aspire to. I took 5 years out of my life to teach myself to draw. I set myself the task of learning how to reinvent the depiction of the human body. I wanted to express my romance about the organism in an emotional way, but also with a degree of accuracy, so that the viewer could relate to it as a human. By this I mean, that if I draw a nose and mouth and imbue it with the drama and emotion that I feel about it, and the viewer says, yes, I felt that way too, I've succeeded. After Vermont, I moved to New York and took studio at Carnegie Hall in 1978. That's where I made many portraits of my friends. I'm proud of that work, but since then, there have been moments when I've made more beautiful things because I know more. By know more, I mean because of all those years of looking at my subjects and of the work of those people who inform me, and because my eyes are old now and have helped my hand dream of the thrill of making marks on paper, I can say I know more. Or probably it would be more accurate to say I'm finally beginning to see. My eyes and my hands mark the paper without interference. The whole point is, if you have the gift that I have, that I was born with, if I had been unencumbered or less encumbered with the psychological baggage that I have carried, I believe I could draw better, because to draw for me, I need to be in a state of grace. I need to be without interior trauma. If I can only draw for 10 minutes, that's enough. Then I do it another day for 10 minutes. I find a way. When I did the Glyptotek drawings in the 80s, it was a different deal. The Glyptotek, by the way, is a museum in Munich, Germany, where that is the collection of Greek and Roman sculpture of the Mad King Ludwig. The museum was closed. There was no noise. There was no distraction. Just a guard who let me in and out, and it was night, so I relied on artificial light. I was focusing on something not alive. I was trying to bring the statues to life, but it was a lot easier than a live person. It was way easier than that. They didn't move, and since they didn't move and I was alone, I could look as long and as hard as I needed to in a place that was closed off and silent. In a certain way, it was the optimal situation, but what is really the optimal situation for me is to get my brain around what I'm trying to do. That's all. I've got to be in that state when I make the drawing. And then my heart and my hand do the looking. I don't make sketches. I don't make studies. A drawing's a drawing. A painting's a painting. There are certain subjects I don't paint. I don't paint portraits. I don't believe I've ever painted a self-portrait. But I've drawn myself a lot with great elaborateness. There's a lot of rubbing out, a lot of bringing back, and certainly working on it for many months. A drawing is a labor for me, not in a bad way, but in an intense way. I'm able to search through drawing for the age and the personality. I look at the way the flesh falls. I want to get it right, but right doesn't mean just anatomically correct. It means to get it right so it's convincing to me as an invention of the face. I have a total connection between my hand and my eye. It's just that I can't see sometimes. Sometimes I can see perfectly. By seeing, I mean it's like an inner eye. It's not just two eyes seeing. It's the memory of how things look, or the memory of how I want them to look. I'm very ambitious for my drawing. When I'm taking out and putting back, I'm not building necessarily. I'm taking out, hoping the next pass across the page will be a touchdown. I'm not erasing because I couldn't get the object accurately, but because I'm hoping for grace to come to me. I don't think hard work makes a good drawing. I've had a lot of students who worked very hard and who really looked hard, and after 2 weeks of drawing would turn out a drawing that was completely dead. Even though it showed rigorous looking, it's not what I want. If I erase, it's because I didn't get what I wanted the first time, and if I don't get it by the 20th time, let's say the paper's halfway gone, then I start to patch the paper. Drawing is not an exercise. Exercise is sitting on a stationary bicycle and going nowhere. Drawing is being on a bicycle and taking a journey. For me to succeed in drawing, I must go fast and arrive somewhere. The quest is to keep the thing alive, the drawing and the state of grace. I get the endorphin high by the intensity of my looking, and it's then that I leave my body. Now that I'm a photographer, it's making me a better draftsman. I'm less interested in focused looking. I'm more interested in being able to draw the feeling I have and to compose something that's harmonious on the page. What's helped me because of my age is that I can't see as well as I did, or I see differently, or I don't look as hard as I did, or my bifocals mess me up, or I'll sometimes look through the top part, the far vision part of my glasses when I'm close up. Some things in the drawing are in focus and some are out. And I've allowed that. It's freed me and allowed my drawings a range of emotions. Anybody can be emotional with a tool like a pencil or a piece of charcoal. You can fake it or make it real. You can be emotional and you can be trite. But to have a range of emotions in just one specific drawing is something I hope for. In my earlier drawings, I wasn't interested in that. I was interested in everything in focus, hard looking, being delicate, making something beautiful. Now I'm more interested in making a vehicle within which it's possible to feel certain things. This range of emotions is not about anger and fear and love and hate. It's about the emotions that come from looking at something visually. And these emotions don't have words. They really don't have words. They are not descriptive. Because of my recent intense use of the camera, in my drawings, I trust clicking of the shutter, so to speak. I want to get my drawing out of my heart the way photography accesses my marginal thoughts and images. For the most part, I draw things I've drawn before because I've chosen these objects as mine, for example, tools. So already I have a relationship with the object because I've drawn them before and I've chosen them because they appeal to me in some primal way. They don't appeal to me necessarily as objects to be glorified, but they're familiar and I want to draw them. The state of wanting to draw something for me is a way to capture it, and that's a primary emotion for me. If I don't have that sense of wanting to capture, then I don't touch it. When I was a boy and I discovered hand tools, I knew I wanted to do something with them. I didn't know what. I just felt they were useful things, and also they were objects to be captured. I can't be more specific than that. It's what I wanted from these things. I wanted to possess them. And what better way of possessing them than to draw them? The reason I wanted to possess them is they reminded me of other things that are wordless. You could say the tools could be a Rorschach test for my psychology, but I don't mean that, although I think there's something in that idea, but it's too limiting and reductive to me and the work. I used to think drawings were things done with pencil, ink, charcoal on paper. In fact, the works on paper that I venerated as a child and then as an artist have been classically monochromatic. But I'm such an artistically rabid personality that once I start to draw with the classical mediums on paper, I always have to take a bite out of color. Or the stuff you spray the trunks of automobiles with, the speckled paint. Or I have to put my foot on the paper and smear the unfixed marks. I always assume the support I am drawing on, paper, wood, on the wall, is a petri dish where the eventual product is hatched, and I'll do anything I can to help it be born. I need a lot of time to make a drawing. I always needed time for my incubation process, but now I need more time because I want so much more from the work and from my romantic unconscious. Drawing is the medium which has been the blood of my life. It allows me and others who are open to human emotion to experience a straightforward view without artifice, but with poetry, I hope. I'm loosening my grip on the high contrast image now, and I no longer care about highlights to delineate the image. I'm more interested in the coming and going of the image in the blink of an eye. I sometimes want, surprisingly, to misplace the image completely and just have the full mass of the object within the rectangle. I'm working through the specificity of the image and losing the illustrative quality of the subject matter, i.e., a man laughing about a certain thing he's just remembered. Now I'm looking at everything without giving importance to any one thing. As I said before, it's about looking, the privilege of looking. Thanks.
The first thing I'll probably do is spill water on the computer because of the natural anathema between technology and myself. If we explode up here and put on fire, as long as someone's got a fire extinguisher to put Jim out. He's more important you do that than me. We're going to talk now for a while, and there are images we're going to bring up, and I'm just, through the computer, through the help of the technical people here at the Perimeter Institute, we're just going to run through images as we talk. And we may not talk about them specifically, or we may. So to some extent, this is a...
Also, you must understand that how awful it is for me to see these images because they're so crappy. I mean, the way they're done. I mean, is awful, and I apologize, but I don't know what the hell else to do. I've tried over the years to make it look good. I mean, to get the right kind of slide or whatever it is, but it's not what the work looks like.
Yeah.
It's only a little smell.
And you can write a letter of complaint to the Pace Gallery in New York and the National Gallery of Art in Washington, because that's where the slides have come from, but that's a different matter. So imagine that these are as good as they actually are, if that's a useful disposition to have. You know, you talk about drawing being the blood of your life, and is it still that?
Well, it's every day since I draw almost every day, either as on paper or on a etching plate. It's the thing that informs everything else I do. Mm-hmm. So by that I mean not any more specifically, but it informs it because I've spent so much time looking and demanding from myself, not, as I said in the little speech, not the accurate anatomical thing. I don't want to be like that. But it's made me focus on something, really something, and made me find a way to express what I mean.
So it's interesting. So this act of looking, which is this intense kind of interrogation of the object or thing looked at, is one side. But then you talk about, on the other hand, needing the state of grace. And I wonder if there are things you can do to encourage that state of grace, which augments the process of looking, and obviously makes the...
No, you cannot encourage the state of grace.
No,
you can't encourage a religious experience, you know.
But is it that, Jim, in the making, is it that, or is it that only in the apprehension after the thing's been made?
Well, when I get something that looks to me like I don't know where it came from and it thrills me, then I figure it came from that state, you know. I mean, yes, I brought it here, probably. Otherwise, you know, I don't know who else.
Ezra Pound once said in the field of literature, but it seems to me it probably works in other ways as well, that technique was the test of a man's sincerity. And by that measure, you would be a very sincere artist then, because technique...
The technique was the
test of a man's sincerity, meaning that an artist, if they don't have technique, they're really not sincere. They may be okay, but they're not really at it. And I wonder...
Well, they're not a whole artist. That's all,
yeah.
You know. But I don't think it's, you know, if you weren't touched to begin with, there's no point in getting, that's what I said. I mean, I've had students who could draw like the wind and look like shit at the end, you know. It just was dead.
I remember seeing one of the films that was done on you, the one where you're teaching, I think it's Salzburg. These students, they're so earnest and they're good. And they come in
and they draw hard.
And then you say, erase it. And they think you're kidding.
Yeah.
I mean, they really don't think you mean erase it. And you do mean erase it, because your sense is if you can get it once, you can get it better again?
Or you can get it better again, I think so. Because you will bring with it the memory of what you did and what you learned. And if you are open to that, then it will be better. And anyway, it's a wonderful, interesting competition with yourself.
Mm-hmm. You say in that essay too that a painting is a painting, there's a drawing is a drawing, but one of the confusions for lookers at your work is that the drawings are so intense, and to talk about 200 layers, you know, to do that number of drawings when you in fact only did four or five drawings over that period of time.
No, the point I was making is that I make a drawing, I make a painting, I don't make sketches, I don't make studies anymore. Mm-hmm. I never have.
Mm-hmm. But the pentimento, I mean, you
I love the pentimento. I love the memory, like I love it in people.
It's not entirely fair to ask artists to cast their mind back, especially as far as I'm going to ask you to cast yours back. After all, you're in your 70s. But one of the things that's amazing in reading the history of American art is how fast your career developed. I mean, you come to New York in 58, you get involved in what are called happenings at that time, we now would probably call that performance. And they're apparently electrifying. By all reports, they were quite remarkable. Do you remember them being so special at the time of the doing them?
Well, they were real homemade. And we were quite young, and it was, It was just, you know, it was the right time to be there. It was the time, as that abstract expression is, the great ones were getting old and settled. And then there was the situation in New York was, then there was a so-called second generation, but they really weren't anything new. They hadn't done. And here we were, you know, Oldenburg and I were out on the street picking up stuff and making something of it. Not just because we couldn't afford paint. We were doing it because we wanted a real piece of the city and express that.
So that's the vast canvas that it was for you.
That's about what?
The
vast
was,
canvas.
Yeah, yes, that was it.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah. But then you distrusted, I mean, the success of these performance pieces were quite remarkable if you read the press at the time.
But if you can imagine, of course I distrusted it. I can you imagine, I mean, one day I'm teaching school, you know, and to little kids, and stealing the art supplies.
Stealing their
exactly. Yeah, stealing the art supplies. Easy. The next minute, I'm in Time magazine. You know,
and not because you were stealing crayons from
right,
kids.
Yeah, exactly.
These days, that's why you'd be in Time magazine. Well, so that's why you distrusted it, because it was too easy.
Well, it seemed that it was, and of course it was. It just was. That was an early example mm-hmm. of media being more important than we were. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I should have known then.
You know. Welcome to the world. But then, I mean, but your reaction, which is interesting, is that you don't find a way to negotiate that success. You leave the country. You go away you go to London for 4 years.
Well, I thought it was a very creative way to negotiate it. You know, I owed my dealer money, and I thought it was great. It was like it worked out beautifully.
That's right. The kids wrap you for money for the crayons. I mean, I know.
The kids started to speak like English boys.
But when you go to London, though, you go there almost to abdicate, to move away from painting too.
I really went to London to find comradeship, as it were, to find a community that hadn't been overtaken by this fame, this idea of being famous, this idea of, not that I was a movie star, anything like that, and certainly I wasn't Warhol, or, you know, but I was from Ohio, you know, this was tough stuff for me. I mean, I couldn't get it all together. When I went to London, it was a gentler place, and it was a more generous place. And it also gave me a chance to correspond with poets in America, mm-hmm. Rather than being frightened to call them, and also a chance to start to make books.
And one of the pieces you do there is you do a couple of major paintings there. They're probably the only paintings you do in that period, the name paintings, where you literally try and record every human being you knew up until that time.
Right. It was 16 feet long, and I started in the upper left corner with my grandpa.
It's a good thing you knew a lot of people. It could have been a very small painting after a while, don't you think?
No, I knew a lot of people. No, I had a big memory, too.
But were you aware, I mean, did it seem a radical painting to do at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a radical painting to do, and it was great to have it. It was as autobiographical as I could get.
Yeah, yeah. That sense of autobiography has played a pretty significant role in my
faith. It's the biggest part of my art. Mm-hmm. It's my, if I was Mirandi, it's my bottles. Mm-hmm. It's my childhood, my bottles.
One of the things I think that people didn't understand in the beginning, and it took a long while for it to cipher down, is that because of the time frame when you come to prominence, which is pop art, those guys were also using popular objects, domestic objects. You were using them in a very different way, weren't you?
Well, they were
tools, for instance.
Excuse me. They were glorifying advertising, media, topography, painting the object as it had been painted by illustrators and things. I was using tools, real tools, in the place of paint many times.
You mean as pigment, almost?
Oh, yeah, of course. And I was using them also as a, not as a glorification of working. It wasn't a social statement. It was talking about the beauty of the object itself, formed by hands and by workers who had designed these things through need. And also, I was talking about what they meant to me unconsciously, and the pleasure they gave me of looking at them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so they were, did they become surrogate self-portraits, or were they merely part of your family?
Well, you know, we all are. I mean, everything I do is a self-portrait. But they were certainly a huge part of my young life.
I was going to say, why not come at it more directly? But you did, in fact. I mean, you do
self-portrait. Come at what more directly?
Well, the question of self-portraiture.
Well, eventually I started to paint myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. And mainly because I sat still. I mean, I didn't have to tell somebody.
No, come on. I mean, the bathrobe comes out of a sense that you felt that in looking at that image in the New York Times magazine, that you could actually fill the bathrobe. So,
well, it looked like I was in it, and I was looking for a way to make a self-portrait, but I didn't want to make the kind of self-portrait I'd make now, that is, from life, as it were, because I was young and I still wanted to be thought of as modern and, you know, it was a snooty, hip idea, which worked out well.
Yeah,
in the end.
It didn't do bad, actually, apparently. But did you also want to avoid doing yourself because you felt that would be too revelatory, Jim, at all in any way? A self-portrait that was more literally you?
No, I couldn't do it well enough. Mm-hmm. I hadn't undertaken the rigorous training that I gave myself. I couldn't get what I wanted.
That was an optical thing? You couldn't render it the way it looked?
It was a concentration thing. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get my mind around it. I had too much on my mind from the past. I was what would probably be diagnosed now as dyslexic, although that's such a big term and it doesn't mean much. It means a certain thing. But I couldn't read and I couldn't think and I couldn't. I was preoccupied. And until I became less preoccupied and more able to focus, then I couldn't make a self-portrait the way I wanted to.
The psychoanalysis which you were involved in for decades and decades, then interrupted, then picked up again, was it a way of, did it feed your head or feed your art, or is that a distinction that's not useful to make?
No, it was a practical thing, keep standing.
Yeah. So it didn't have anything to do with the work, actually.
Well, of course it did. I mean, otherwise I couldn't have done anything. But it was not. It helped me tend the flame, but it. And more than that, it allowed me a decent night's sleep. Mm.
What was it that you were able to do in England that allowed you, like 4 years later, in 1971, you come back to America and you go to Vermont and start that intense process of drawing from the figure that, I mean, produced these extraordinary drawings that, I mean, they remain extraordinary. But why did you leave? Had you used England up, or had you got what you needed from your self-imposed abdication?
No, but I left for very mundane reasons. I left because my boys were getting older, and I didn't understand the English educational system. So I didn't know what to do with them. I didn't know whether they were young. They weren't teenagers yet, but they were just about. And I didn't know what the hell am I supposed to do with them. It's a public school. It's not a public school. It's a state school. You know, boys go away to school too soon, as far as I was concerned. What the hell was going on? And I understood, you go back, you go in the eighth grade. You know.
Or drive taxi or something.
Yes, I mean, I'm trying to make a drawing, you know. I'm not Horace Mann.
Okay, so all right. So, but you go to Vermont, you don't go to New York.
No, I couldn't go back there at that point. I just didn't. And often I regret not putting myself directly back into the scene, things like that. But on the other hand, living in Vermont, I lived on and off for 15 years in Vermont, informed me about a discipline of working, and also informed me about nature in a way I had not been as informed since I was a boy.
But all these years, I've known you, talked to you, I've never heard you say you maybe regretted not going back to New York. What would be the nature of the regret? It's not as if the career hasn't gone well or you haven't been able to make the work you want.
It's been great.
Sorry, so now that we got that over with, what would the regret have been? Sort of plugging into the
You know, I missed a whole bar life. Mm-hmm. I missed, fun.
Yeah.
I missed music.
Well, if you didn't spend so much time on a single drawing, you'd have more fun. You could have let it go.
Exactly.
Jeez. Exactly. Didn't anybody tell you, Jim, you can let this one go?
But I'll tell you something. I don't sit around and regret it. I'm just saying that it would have been more fun probably, but it was the thing to do, and it was appropriate for the time.
The audience have been looking at drawings from that period in which you're using objects and you're really attacking the canvas. Did you give yourself permission to say that the surface of the drawing, that you could basically do anything with it? Or was that something that developed as you drew? I mean, the piece right now, I mean, the skier is it seems like a pretty radical drawing even now, yet alone.
You mean where I ripped her face?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah.
I do and have done always radical things. I use one of my methods is anger. Anger at the piece, that it's not getting where I want it to go. And so many times in my anger, I really attacked it like that. Mm. And then I realized, because my anger's over, that it's a plus. It was like, so therefore I say that my anger has been a constructive medium. Mm. Because I've been able to leave it. I mean, I once did a drawing that I got so pissed off with that I sponged it down and rolled it into a ball and threw it against the wall. And after I did that, I unpeeled it carefully and put it back on the wall. It dried and it's fine. I just elaborated on it,
Yeah.
I mean, nobody got hurt, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm not sure I know what to say about it. You know, if you'd recorded that, it would have also been a performance piece. You just didn't have the technology you needed at the time.
But it would have been boring. It's been done before.
Yeah.
Drawing violence is boring.
Yeah, that's right. And so then, I mean, but you gained the confidence of the ability to depict that then allowed you to paint literally, to draw yourself
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
I gained the confidence, and through drawing, I'm able now to draw with a good deal more pleasure and confidence, and in fact, find new ways. As I said, and I didn't quite get it across, I realized in what I wrote, much of the drawing I do now is I sit, I draw, I walk away, I walk by it, I pass by it, I make a mark, pass by it again, I make another mark, I leave it alone for a few days, I take out a grinder, the grinder takes over from my hand, rips up the paper, like there's been a lightning bolt hitting it, and then everything goes back to normal. And I'll spend a long time looking hard, and then I'll erase again and leave it alone for a long time. It's that kind of thing. It's like watching seedlings come out of the ground.
When you talk about the anger at the piece, one would naturally say the anger was also at yourself for not being able to achieve what you wanted. So that you and
of
the drawing,
course, yeah, of course,
yeah. It's just yeah. But no one gets you. Don't get hurt in the process of not being able to get what you want.
I don't get what?
Get hurt? I mean, when you say no one gets hurt, I mean
well, no one gets hurt in the sense that I'm not attacking another human, nor myself. What I'm doing is, and somewhere I know this probably, I'm distressing my intended masterpiece.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. The same. You're an interesting. It's not a contradiction, but the streams that feed your sensibility. One side of it is a deep-rooted expressionism. You've described yourself as a European expressionist, you know, from...
I come from that tradition.
From that tradition, that's right. And then at the same time, you have this veneration for a classical tradition that comes out of the Glyptotek drawings and that kind of... It's almost a veneration. Those two things for you aren't contradictory, are they? They're part of the same...
It's just me. I was exposed to classical sculpture at the Cincinnati Art Museum when I was a little boy by my mother. And then eventually I would go, and it was a romance with the ancient world, besides everything else. And I went to a high school in Cincinnati, a public high school, that was based on the Boston Latin School. It was 6 years, and you had to take Latin, and it was during a traumatic time in my life. I went through the time I was 12 till I was 18, and I did as poorly as anybody ever did in school, and I was a bad boy, and I couldn't concentrate. Yet, when I got to the Glyptotek and saw those sculptures, I felt the connection with the so-called ancient world. And when you have started to do this, to sit there at night, as the director so generously and charmingly allowed me to do, came in every night, 2 in the morning, something like that, I stayed till 10, till people came. And you sit there, and you're able to make a meditation on the work of a nameless sculptor, somebody who was you, I mean, related to you. It is a great privilege. It's a real thrill. And that romance with the ancient world and with these artists who created this beauty is something that I wanted to do, to talk about in my drawing.
Mm-hmm. And your sense, I mean, so the past for you is it actually back then, or is it in the process of working with it, is it right now? I mean, I have this... I have this romance about you in the Glyptotek, I mean, all alone, you and these works that you're looking at by artists that you may not know. You're so intensely involved in this. It's not something that comes from the past, it's obviously something that is very present for you. I guess what I'm asking is the act of making something, make everything in the present, in the moment of making.
Yeah, sure. I'm not in the past when I do this.
Yeah, yeah. And the past doesn't matter in that way. It's not that you're...
Can't matter. I don't know what the past was, except mm-hmm. this object that has been made that way. Mm-hmm. I can think about it, I can read, and get some idea, but I'm not sure we know that anyway. But it's like when you see a fragment that's been broken, you know, and we know that that's very modern. That we, you know, it isn't what the Greeks were venerating. Mm-hmm. That they were looking at highly polychrome sculptures that we now see as with just a little trace sometimes here of red or something. Or we see a nose knocked off, or a penis knocked off, or a hand gone. Very modern, you know. So we bring to it that. Mm-hmm. It suits us. We tailor it to our needs now, visual needs.
What can you? Is there a difference for you between painting and drawing?
Of course. So of course there is, but I couldn't paint if I didn't draw because it made the paintings more specific. But otherwise, you're smearing. You know, otherwise, it's not, you know, it made it more specific. It gave me a matrix. Mm.
So the drawing is, in one sense, then a discipline for the painting?
It's discipline for everything.
Ah.
It probably informs the way I drive. You know, mm-hmm. really.
Mm-hmm. Are you, when the scale of your work, one of the things that American artists have always, the scale is the whale that almost swallowed up American art in some ways. How did you approach the question of scale? Like, what determines for you how big something should be?
Well, what I can reach.
It's that physical, yeah. So, you know, we have ladders, you know, and I mean, it's not as if there's a... it's that simple.
Yeah, and I've invented tools to extend it, my hand, you know. Mm-hmm.
This particular portrait here is one that I always thought, and I don't know why, I always think of Bonar when I see this. There's a famous a Bonar where he's looking.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, you know
thank
the one?
You. Yeah.
You figure, but that obviously wasn't in your, you didn't have Bonar in the back
not
of your
in my
mind.
Head. It's not in my head, no.
But the artists you love are those artists that you call, they're in the tradition almost of kind of lonely artists. It's Morandi and Munch, Giacometti, Balthus. Yeah, well, Dubuffet we can talk about. But are those natural inclinations that you move towards? Why are those artists the cluster of guys that you like, do you think?
Because they were alone. They were alone. That's the way I feel I am. You know? Mm-hmm. That's when we spoke, when you speak about that I was a pop artist, you know. I was an artist alone. I wouldn't have had it any other way. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have had it. I had no other way of being other than to be what I was. They spoke to me that way, mm-hmm. you know. There was no club I was in, mm-hmm. you know. I grew up in a time when they spoke about the club, the artist club. Clinton Klein, all these people, you know, I could never have been in any club.
I mean, just, in fact, you've almost religiously resisted and moved away from situations yeah. which you could ever even be, they may not want you, you know, you've been invited to all the best parties
right.
once, you know, so it's not
no,
a problem.
No, but it's just one of my kinks.
Has that made it easier to make work, that sense of soul? I mean,
it's not easy to make work, but it probably is easier to make work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yet you found the company of writers to be very interesting to you.
I've been able to speak with writers easier without having to you know, without having a kind of macho barroom scene where you have to you know, I did this, I did this, man, you know, I did this. Yeah. The poets I've known have been very generous to me, mm-hmm. and both to me as a poet and as a painter. And no painter has ever been as generous to me as the poet Robert Creeley. Mm-hmm. I mean, no one ever came near to that.
Early on, de Kooning actually said some nice things about you, didn't he? I mean, I'm scrambling in my art history to remember a painter who said something nice about you.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's not Jim's fault. That's the painter's fault.
He only said one thing to me.
And was it nice?
It was okay. He said, you know, Dime, you're a real painter. I said, I already knew that. I wasn't a policeman.
Jim told me earlier today. Robert Motherwell, they went to have lunch, and Robert Motherwell said, you know, Dines, I'm Stravinsky, but I'm sorry, I should get this right. He said, you know, Dines, he didn't bother getting his name right. You know, Dines, I'm Stravinsky, and you're Sinatra. I know. But I don't
it was okay.
I don't think he knew how good Sinatra was when he said that, did he?
No. It was just East Coast snootiness.
But it's interesting that that the tribe of painters has not been a tribe you've hung out with too much
no,
in your
it's
life.
No, true.
Yeah,
it's true.
But what about Kitai in England when you went there? Kitai was a painter who you
about who?
Kitai? I thought.
What about him?
Well, I thought you liked him for a while.
Yeah, he's okay.
Jim, you know, Jim's going to do this to me now. You know, it's going to be every question is going to be well. He was all right. He was all right. But so the inspiration for you comes out of the life in art. It doesn't come from these peripheral things. I mean, you say you missed the bar scene in New York. Obviously, you haven't needed it, because if you had
exactly.
needed it, you would have found it. You know, you found the life you needed.
Correct.
It's been the life of being alone.
Correct.
You know, you got to give me more than one word on every question, because I don't have. Because, I mean, I can talk
Listen,
a lot, but I don't have a...
I'll tell you something. I feel absolutely blessed that I'm able to put one word in front of the other. I've just gotten off an airplane.
An airplane. So. I've got to say that Mr. and Mrs. Dine came all the way from Paris for this lecture. So, you know, that the wonder he doesn't come to Canada very often for 35 years.
You're going to have to give me a better question.
Well, all right. I knew it was going to come to that, you know. I adore this painting. Well, I got to go back. This one, Jim, the two hearts, because I think it's Masonic. I think you joined the Masons when you did this one, you know. And don't you think it's kind of scary painting?
A lot of people are scared by the eye and the heart. I thought it perfectly natural. it just seemed the thing to do, you know. I've always loved that eye, that warding off the evil eye. I once saw a fork made by a Persian Jew in Israel, where he engraved the eye right there and had the tines going like that. And it was a really powerful object.
Well, it's to ward off the evil eye, isn't it, that object? Is that what you, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm always going for anything.
And there'd be a lot of evil eyes you want to ward off, because those are pretty good-looking hearts, you know. I don't
they're
know. I guess you knew that.
Full.
Yeah, they're fulsome hearts, that's right. I mean, you've painted the nude a lot. Is that as a subject matter? Is it getting the nude that you're after? Or why all of those drawings you did for so long? Could they, a lot of them were nude, some were clothed, like the Russian poetess, but others weren't. Is there something about the nude? Because this whole question of the gaze, of course, as you know, has been very problematic in the 20th century. Men looking at women, that was never an issue?
You mean why did I paint them, draw them nude?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Oh, because of the romance I spoke about. I mean, the idea of how nature has put us together is so mm-hmm. beautiful. And that's why I used Jessie Heller all those years. She was borderline anorectic and a marathon runner. And when you saw her arm fitting into her shoulder, it was absolutely beautiful. Beautiful the way nature developed this. As a mature woman, mm-hmm. to see that, it came from a little, brittle, little childish bone, you know, mm-hmm. 20 years before, and suddenly it was a sophisticated tool.
And does your love of botanical drawing then come out of that same, in a sense, admiration for the way the world is put together?
Yes, it is, and also it comes from I was raised by my grandma, and every summer, every spring, she went to the greengrocer and bought some tomatoes, and she came home. We lived in Ohio. It was hot down there on the Ohio River, and she went out in the garden and went like this. And she squeezed the tomato and stepped on it, and that was that. Now, it's miraculous. I'm sorry to be corny about it, but that's my deal with botanical drawings. It's trying to, you know, if I get a crassula plant like that, and I'm able to work on that for 15 years, which I did on and off, and I can bring it to that point. To me, it's miraculous that I was able to get my hand to do that, that's all. You know, that you can make a drawing grow like that.
Now, do you mean that particular drawing or the...
I'm talking about this drawing, yeah.
I
started it in the middle 70s, and I don't know how it's dated, but I think it's late 80s,
mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. So working at things over a period of time, you do have drawings that, in fact, you date over a progression of time. Is that meant to be an accurate reflection of how long it took you to make it, or when you come back to it and you record the completion date?
I don't know.
You really don't? You don't know?
I don't know why I do it. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of romantic to think that you worked that long on it, I guess. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I really don't.
And how do you decide what medium you'll work in, Jim? I mean,
it decides for me what's at hand.
You mean if you've got a wood around, you'll make an ape and cat sculpture, or if you've got a...
No, what's at hand? If I'm wanting to draw, and there's something I really want to draw in, I mean, and I think, oh, that'd be great, using pastel or thing, and it's not there, and I got a stick that I, you know, picked up, and the stick I could make on the paper a mark, I would use that stick. You know, I would find a way. That's my method, though. My method, as I said, is correcting and adding. Mm-hmm. And it's also using what's there, what's possible, making it possible. It's a kind of, it's like we could get to Pinocchio now. Pinocchio, the story of Pinocchio is a kind of metaphor for art. Mm-hmm. You know, this guy, Geppetto, is given this present of a talking stick, and he ultimately makes it into a boy. It brings it to life. It's my aspiration as an artist.
To bring the inanimate thing to life?
Exactly. To bring the inanimate to life. Mm-hmm.
So that love, I mean, obviously...
To make it live.
Yeah. You know. So that love of the, I mean, the early, I mean, I'm not going to, God knows, somebody who's been involved with psychiatry as long as you have, but clearly that love of the so-called inanimate objects that came out of the hardware store, that has been a lifelong love affair.
Absolutely.
And will always be.
Absolutely.
And this piece, by the way, this is a piece from, isn't it, from one of your recent shows at Pace McGill. And it's very similar to the one that you'd done from the 1962 or 63, isn't it? The kind of, I think of it as the wrenches descending a staircase.
How cute.
I know. It's the only cute thing I'm going to say all night,
really?
By the way. We're moving on. You know, you like art history. So one of the things that this is a piece also from your fairly recent show at Pace McGill.
Not Pace McGill.
Sorry, that's the photography side of it. It's going to lead
Pace
me.
Pace McGill's the photo gal.
It's going to lead me too quickly to that, too, because, I mean, because you do so much photography. But Pace Wildenstein,
yeah.
the painting show, these were very, they seemed like very aggressive.
Aggressive?
Paintings, yeah. I like them for the way that they seem to attack almost your own earlier work, because they clearly come out of, I mean, 40 years ago you were doing work like this,
of course,
but not kind of like this. What drove you to make these particular paintings? This, I think you made them over a summer, didn't you?
It's hard to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's too specific to make. Why I made these specific paintings, there once again, I'm revisiting my love of tools, and I'm once again, I'm reiterating that a branch or an axe or a broom or whatever it is, to me, can be used as effectively as yellow or red or blue. Mm-hmm.
This gets us close to the end. When you're doing work now, do you feed off of your own earlier work? I mean, when you look at work like this, there's all kinds of painters who are using material on surfaces and have been for a long time or using a linear sense. You're not paying attention to other artists, I gather. The attention you pay is the attention to your own, having worked through these things. That I guess I'm asking, is the world largely self-referential now as you make art out of it?
Well, it's not like I'm not aware of what's happening in the world, but I have done certain things, and it would be absolutely wasteful if I didn't act upon them and use them and refer to them, because I've made them mine. And it's a valuable resource. Mm-hmm. It's my glossary of terms.
And near the end, the photography that you've been working at so diligently over the last, I mean, it's been longer than most people think, actually. Your photo-based work is a major part of your practice right now. Has the camera been a tool? I mean, how long have you actually worked with the camera as a way of making art?
Since 1994.
Mm-hmm. And now it's, I mean, you do a lot of it. It's obviously become a very important part of your art making. How does it relate to what you've done before?
How does what relate to
it? The photography.
Well, a lot. It's me, and a lot of the subject of what I photograph, tools and other things, but and portraits and mm-hmm. things, are there. But, you know, it's allowed me to access my unconscious.
Hmm. Quicker.
So quick that I don't have to censor it. We all do that. We all censor. I mean, if I sit down and I want to talk about some big thing that I think I can talk about in painting because I'm now glib enough to draw like that and things like that, somewhere along the line, the governor comes down, you know? Then this great saboteur says, you can't do that, you can't say that. With the camera, all you do is go, and you see what you find eventually. And it's been so inspiring for me.
So at that point, though, it's not manual in the making as much as it's the seeing. Now you're relying more on a pure sense of seeing.
Seeing, yeah.
And that's sufficient? I mean, that satisfies you? It gives you pleasure?
It gives me a lot of pleasure. All I lose in it is surface.
You know. Boy, I lose
it.
All
but I trade. The trade is the fast access of the unconscious. Mm-hmm. So I see things that I didn't know I thought about. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a gift. That's really a gift. I actually think, I also have a sense of show business. And I think this is enough.
Yeah, it's funny you said that because we just did our last slide.
Ah, good. Thanks, folks.
Thank you very much. Now,
do you want to entertain a couple of questions? Do you want to entertain a couple of questions or go upstairs?
We can try a few questions.
Jim, we'll have some questions from the audience. What we'd urge you to do, though, there are apparently microphones, and we prefer if you stand and ask them. I think that's for reasons of hearing. So I think the microphones are out there, or will be. So if you have a question, just put up your hand, and these very fine people will find you, and Jim will answer anything you ask. And I'll be ruthless. If there's not a question coming, if there's a statement in a novel being written, I'll just shut you down right away, and we'll just go on to someone else. So keep that in mind. No questions?
What your thoughts and feelings are on that?
If you can elaborate on the state of grace that you talked about. Yeah, what it is.
Yeah. And let's say, I'll make it as simple as I can, because I can't, it's very personal, too, so it's very hard for me, since we don't know each other, you know. But it's if you're going along and you're drawing, for instance, it happens other ways, too, but if you're going along, you're drawing, and it's difficult, and you've rubbed out, and you've put back in, and you think maybe it needs some color, or do this, you do that, and it just looks terrible. And you're going along, you're going along, you're going along, and you've lost, I lose track sometimes of what it was I was thinking of that, and I suddenly look, and it's there. Well, then clearly, I had some help, you know? That's what I mean.
But the clouds didn't open like Yahweh.
No, it's not there. Nothing like that. Okay. Nothing like that.
There's another question there. If you can use the mic, it would help. Thank you.
You talked about drawing and about painting, but you haven't referred to your sculpture in your art practice. Can you tell us something about your sculpture?
You talked about drawing and painting, but you didn't talk about the sculpture, so you want to talk a little bit about that, about your sculpture.
Nobody asked me until you did. I've been making sculpture all my life. A lot of the so-called assemblages that I made in the early 60s, I mean, they are sculpture. And a lot of sculpture I made then was with clothes or rags put together. And I think it wasn't so permanent. A lot of it didn't last. But when I started to really draw, and when I started to also make a few portraits in plaster, and I wanted to find a way to cast them. And eventually I met a man through a dealer, a guy I show with in San Francisco. I met a man who's an artist, a West Coast artist called Manuel Neri. And I said, "Where you cast your sculpture?" And he told me, it was in Walla Walla, Washington. And I went up and saw this guy. And he made it easy for me. And he showed me about what lost wax was and made it easy for me. So in the last 25 years, I've made fair amount of sculpture, and it's a different, obviously, process than drawing, but I couldn't do it without the drawing, just that it takes a long time. Not making it, but producing it, you know, and that sometimes it takes the edge off. I lose interest. I've been making these big sculptures of Pinocchio, but I've been making them with a chainsaw and chisels, so that I can see it finished, and then I paint them, you know.
It's a Walla Walla chainsaw massacre up there that's going on, right? But I mean, you are as aggressive with this. You'll be as aggressive with the sculpture as you have been with the drawings and paintings, then too, haven't you? Won't you?
Yeah. 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 But I work with a wonderful couple of guys who are able to correct with the chainsaw, and they can put it back on.
Yeah. The amputations aren't perfect.
Yeah. Okay.
There was a question up there, I believe, gentlemen.
You've used the term "looking hard" like kind of looking hard at something. You used that a number of times, and I was wondering if there's a difference, how you might describe the difference between looking hard when you're drafting or when you're sketching, and when you use the camera.
I know. Like I said, to make one drawing, I could make 1,000 photographs, but I'm still looking hard. And when I choose the photograph I want to print, it's the same technique. Then I'm really looking hard. But to get it to that point with the camera, it's you're blinking your eye. And I think that's a lovely thing to have happen. I know I didn't answer what you wanted, but I can't think of what to say else.
One more question, and then we'll go upstairs. Gentleman here.
I go on my nerve. I try to forge ahead. I try not to be frightened. It's like a whistle in the dark. I try to go ahead and go further rather than have the darkness consume me.
And on that, I think you're all welcome to come upstairs to the bistro and meet with Mr. Dine and ask him questions.
I thought we've met already.
All right. Please join.